Hey, everybody. Happy Sunday. This episode's very important. It was a live speech I gave at Dream City Church, the Barnett's Church in Phoenix, Arizona. If you guys are looking for a church in Arizona, I encourage you to go there. I take questions from the audience, and in fact, we talk about some upcoming school board things that need to be fixed in Arizona. Email us your thoughts, freedom@charliekirk.com, in this extensive speech about what Christians need to do here on Sunday, advertiser free. And if maybe you had a great year, maybe you got some stimulus money, and you want to support us, go to charliekirk.com/support. Again, that's charliekirk.com/support. Buckle up, everybody. Here we go.
Charlie, what you've done is incredible here.
Maybe Charlie Kirk is on the college campus.
I want you to know we are lucky to have Charlie Kirk.
Charlie Kirk's running the White House, folks.
I want to thank Charlie. He's an incredible guy. His spirit, his love of this country. He's done an amazing job building one of the most powerful youth organizations ever created, Turning Point USA.
We will not embrace the ideas that have destroyed countries, destroyed lives, and we are going to fight for freedom on campuses across the country. That's why we are here.
Thank you. Wow. Thank you, guys. Thank you. So Pastor Luke and Tommy and to the Dream City staff and to everyone here, I want to thank you guys for this act of boldness for doing this tonight. And so it is so necessary. And before I go any further, this is not the most important thing I'm doing this week. On Saturday, Eric and I are getting married, which is very exciting. So no matter how good it goes tonight, there will be something more important that happens this week. But Luke, let it be known that two great things are started in this week in 2021 in May in Phoenix, Arizona. I also want to thank some other people here tonight. I want to thank my pastor, Rob McCoy, who came in from Thousand Oaks, California, who has just been amazing to me in so many different ways. I first met Rob, it was about a year and a half, 2 years ago, and he was mayor of Thousand Oaks, California during the Baseline shooting. You might remember where nine people lost their lives to a shooter. And he was a pastor who ran for local government. And the city needed a pastor at that time as mayor. And I when I met him, I said, wait a second, you mean that as a pastor, you're able to run for local office? And we got to talking, and I realized growing up in a Bible-believing church, how Christians have not leaned into their proper role in the public square in our country. And I've spoken over 70 churches in the last year. 70. I spoke from Seattle, which I just came from, and that was an interesting event, to Steve Smotherman's church in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You got a great church, by the way. And I realized that if the church does not rise up at this moment, if the church does not take its proper role, then the country and the republic will be gone as we know it. And so, as I spoke at so many of these different churches, I realized that when I was speaking to the body of Christ, they weren't just listening to what I was saying. In this wonderful church, we had a great time a couple weeks ago. They were waiting for me to tell them what to do. You know, Christians in America, we're action-oriented. Whether it be parking cars or doing amazing things in Colorado City, it's not in our DNA to sit idly by when something bad is happening. It's not, we don't need convincing. Once we see a problem, we want to be part of the solution. And so I pitched this idea to the Barnetts, and Rob and I were talking about it, and Steve and I have been talking about it. What if the churches of this country and pastors started to take a more public stance? So this, I really was inspired by a couple verses. And it's an answer to a question that some people have, which is why should Christians care about government? Why should Christians care about the public square? We kind of hear that every so often, right? Let that happen itself, and we're just going to kind of worry about the church. They always say separation of church and state, which is not in the U.S. Constitution. But I think it's a single letter that Thomas Jefferson wrote to the Danbury Baptist Convention. But I think if this last year taught us anything, it's time to try to keep the state out of the church. After they told the church that it's not essential, after they came into our ability to worship. In Jeremiah 29:7, it says, "Seek the peace and prosperity of the city to which I have carried you into exile. Pray to the Lord for it, because if the city prospers, you will also prosper." We are commanded to care about the city of which we are in. So I'm going to start really broad here tonight. I'm going to talk about why Christians need to care about what's happening around you. And then I'm going to get really specific. By really specific, I'm going to read you curriculum that your children are learning from here in Arizona. I'm going to get even more specific. I'm going to tell you the school board that approved it. I'm going to get even more specific. I'm going to tell you when that school board is meeting in the next couple weeks if you find this curriculum to be somewhat disagreeable. Because, and it's always important to remember, everything we do as Christians needs to be full of grace, gentle, kind, but also 100% truth. And if we see something in our local community, we should do something about that. So why should we care about the world around us? Well, in Proverbs 29:2, it says, when the righteous increase, the people rejoice. But when the wicked rule, the people groan. You've been probably doing a lot of groaning recently, right? You've been doing a lot of, man, I wish they weren't doing that. That doesn't reflect my values. You know, I came from Illinois, and it's a good place to be from, by the way. In Illinois, we have term limits. It's one term in office, one term in jail. A little different than most states. And I came here to Arizona seeking freedom. And now I'm looking around seeing the same sort of decisions being made. And by the way, I'm not even talking politically. I'm talking of the moral, cultural issues of the day that then result into political decisions. Because in Illinois, I saw a church that decided they were not going to get in the public square. And Illinois has one of the largest churches in America. You guys all know it. But they decided always they were not going to get involved in any sort of moral or cultural issues. And I think that was a mistake. So this is actually an inflection point here in Arizona. So as we're broadcasting this to the entire nation, I also want to make sure I talk to the people in this room, because if we don't care about the local issues, the issues where we can look people eye to eye on, and we just always act as if the most important thing is Washington, D.C., we're fooling ourselves. Because it's actually easier to hope that everything's going to be solved on Air Force One. But the tougher fights, the ones that happen really locally. So how about three examples of how Christians have influenced our world that we're living in right now for good? So this is the basic reason why we should care about government, is that we should always try to impact everything for God's purpose. Music, arts, entertainment, business, finance, and yes, even government and civic life. Well, how about the founding of our country? The founding of this beautiful country, is it just like any other country? Well, John Jay, the first Supreme Court Justice of the United States, says, quote, Providence has given to our people the choice of their rulers, and it is the duty as well as the privilege and interest of our Christian nation to select and prefer Christians for their rulers. John Jay, first Supreme Court Justice of the United States. How about a signer of the Declaration of Independence? One of the most amazing quotes, which is right here, Benjamin Rush, signer of the Declaration from Pennsylvania, who was speaking out against slavery, saying domestic slavery is repugnant to the principles of Christianity. It is a rebelling against the authority of a common father. It is a practical denial of the extent and efficacy of the death of a common savior. It is an usurpation of the prerogative of the great sovereign of the universe who has solemnly claimed an exclusive property in the souls of men. You see, this country was founded by people that were prayerful, spirit-filled, Bible-believing Christians that took an act of faith. You see, why do we call the founders pilgrims? They weren't going to Israel. Usually you call people pilgrims when they're going to the Holy Land. They were going to a barren and desolate land. And they signed a document called the Mayflower Compact. It's only about two paragraphs long. They actually signed it while they were still at sea. And they signed it as a promise amongst each other. It's one of the most important documents ever written. It was one of the first documents where they said, hey, when we hit the shores, there's going to be nothing waiting there. We don't know if we're going to get killed or die. We know this. We're going to have to figure out how to govern ourselves. And the most important thing when we try to govern ourselves is not King George, but it's going to be God. That's basically what that document said. And if you don't like it, go try to figure it out yourselves. That's a massive step forward. The founding of this country, the 56 men who signed the Declaration of Independence, the great majority, and some historians believe all, identified themselves as Christians. And all but one were Protestants. Four were either present or former ministers, and a number of the signers were sons of the clergy. At least half of them studied divinity at various universities, and the denominations were between Episcopalian, Anglican, and mainstream Protestantism. John Adams, the second American president, said, quote, "I have examined all religions, and the result is that the Bible is the greatest book ever to exist in the history of the world." What I'm getting at here is that this country was not founded by deists. It was not a mistake of the Enlightenment. In fact, it was something that happened right before it, which is what we call the First Great Awakening. The First Great Awakening were activist pastors known as the Black Robe Regiment standing up in churches and open-air forums across America, contesting for the welfare of the city which they are in. Jonathan Edwards, "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God," telling people to repent and to find a new connection with their ultimate purpose, the sovereign and the almighty God. Once people started to think about this, they started to ask the question, well, if we are free in Christ, why are we not free in this government we have with King George? You see, it was Christians and pastors that even started this line of thinking. And it's only going to be Christians and pastors that can get us back to that. How about abolishing slavery? Now, first of all, let me first say, America was not founded on slavery. And one of the things we're going to be doing here at Freedom Square, we're going to have a chance to do some questions. We're going to have a Socratic element of this, which you don't find too often in colleges, universities, and high schools anymore. We're going to get deep into the history. I believe that one of the main issues of why we're not seeing enough action is that people do not know prior courageous action that preceded them. And one of the big lies that happens in our country is that America was founded on slavery. The first draft of the United States, the Declaration of our country by Thomas Jefferson, in his original handwriting, was him rejecting and blaming King George for an unspeakable sin of slavery. Thomas Jefferson wrote in the first draft of the Declaration of Independence, being a slave owner himself, and by the way, none of us ever are hypocrites, right? None of us ever have sinned, and we never have done anything wrong, right? We're all perfect. We try to judge the founding fathers. There's actually a really good verse for that. Thomas Jefferson said, "King George has waged a cruel war against human nature itself, violating its most sacred rights of liberty and life in the persons of distant people who never offended him, captivating and carrying them into slavery in another hemisphere or to incur miserable death in the transportation there within." Thomas Jefferson was blaming King George, saying, there's something wrong that's happening here. Thomas Jefferson, being the third American president, signed a moratorium saying the slave trade in the United States is over. In fact, how about the first new part of land in America, the Northwest Territories? No, it wasn't Seattle or Idaho. It was Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, and Michigan. That was considered to be the Northwest back then. That was the first new land. So when you go into new land, that should be a reflection of your values. That's a pretty, when you go into a new house, you're saying, I'm going to start a new life. This is my value system, right? Not what came before, but I'm going to put what I believe into what is new. Well, the Northwest Territories, which was signed into law, one of the first acts of Congress ever, by President George Washington, they had a decision to make. We got all this territory. You can grow crops. You can travel. It's fertile land. Should it be slave or free? Well, the Northwest Territories, the first new sovereign part of land that we have documented history of on our planet, was free. It was a free land. It was not a slave land. And that changed the trajectory of our nation, where it said, hey, slavery ends at the Ohio River. That the new territories in America were going to be free territories. Now, mind you, of course the founding fathers wrestled with abolishing slavery in the American South. But that was actually a minority opinion. It was becoming less popular until who I consider to be the great villain of American history, someone you should all be very familiar with, John C. Calhoun, who was vice president to Andrew Jackson and to John Quincy Adams. He came up with a bad idea, an evil idea, where he misrepresented the text of the Bible, which we've never seen happen ever before, right? It warns us about this in 1 Peter, by the way, to justify slavery in a very contorted and pernicious and evil way through the Bible. It resulted in the second thing that Christians influenced our world for good, which is the abolition of slavery in our country. Abraham Lincoln, who some people said he wasn't a Christian, but he famously said he only read two things, and that's where he got his morals from. He read the Bible every night, he read the Shakespeare every month, and that's where he got his worldview from. And Abraham Lincoln famously said, if slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong. In fact, the idea that we were able to abolish slavery in our country is a very, very consequential and big deal. But who was it that inspired William Wilberforce? What was it, I should say? It was the teachings and the writings of the scriptures. In fact, the Supreme Court of Mississippi ruled in 1818, slavery is condemned by reason and the laws of nature. It exists and can only exist through municipal regulations. And in no matter of doubt, courts must learn to rule in favor of life and liberty. And so as we look at American history, it's always been the church and pastors that have decided to step up on big public forums and say, this is right and this is wrong. It is Christians that have decided to rise up and say, I'm not just going to be a spectator. I'm going to get into the game. And then it comes to the third example that I want to explore with you, which is something that I mentioned here before that when I spoke at, which is, why didn't communism work here? Now, I don't make it a habit to read a lot in my speeches. You guys know that. But I wanted to make sure I was very precise in why we are doing this project together and why and what we're going to try to do here in the state of Arizona. I'm going to read this, which is a sermon given by a pastor. If a pastor gave this sermon today, in most churches, he would be run out. And I want you to guess who it is and no saying it out loud. This was given in the 1950s. The communist revolution that was born in the hearts of Marx and Engels in the middle of the 19th century is not going to give up or retreat. No amount of words at the United Nations or peace conferences in the Far East is going to change the minds of communism. It is here to stay. It is a battle to the death. Either communism must die or Christianity must die. Has it ever occurred to you that the devil is a religious leader and millions are worshiping at a shrine today? The name of this present-day religion is communism. The devil is their god and Marx is their prophet. Lenin is their saint and Malenkov their high priest, or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, denying their faith and all ideologies except their religion of revolution. These diabolically inspired men seek in devious and various ways to convert a peaceful world to the doctrine of death and destruction. So fanatical and ruthless are these disciples of Lucifer that in 30 years they have slaughtered millions of innocent people and stood prepared with poised weapons to kill millions in an all-out effort to spread their doctrines to the ends of the earth. What is so subtle about the creed of communism? What sort of ideology does capture the loyalty of countless millions of around the world? Politically, a communist is one who believes the state is supreme and the individual exists only for the welfare of government. Economically, a communist believes in the replacement of private property and land and capital by common ownership. Socially, a communist does not believe in marriage as an institution of God, but only as a merely biological arrangement to have children and heirs to the communist state. Ethically, the communist is a believer, a devotee to the big lie. Theologically, the communist is an atheist, a despoiler of churches and a murderer of Christians. A war of ideologies is being waged throughout the world and in here in America. A war of the secular against the spiritual. The actual battle in the areas of combat are only material manifestations of the larger battle that rages in the hearts of men throughout the earth. Will it be truth or a lie that wins? Will we be motivated by materialistic philosophy or spiritual power? Will we be led by the Jehovah God or duped by Satan? The battle lines are clearly drawn. Billy Graham, 1954. If Billy Graham could speak out on the moral issues and call it what it is, every pastor in the country can speak out on the moral issues of what's going on in America today. So I want to share a couple of the verses, and then I want to start to get more and more specific. Because this is going to be a forum, and we're going to have a chance for you to talk about what's happening in the community around you. Everything we want you to be thinking about is the why and then the how. Why should I do this? And then how do I get it done? Because we as Christians, we do not sit idly by when a great injustice is occurring. We should never be indifferent to the suffering of others. Ever. We as Christians will never allow lies to govern our society. Remember, Jesus did not just speak truth. He was truth. He was the embodiment of truth. And we as Christians must speak right and wrong. We as Christians must be leaders, not complainers. It's not enough just to watch Fox News, Tucker Carlson, and buy the pillow and hope that's going to save Western civilization. Promo code Kirk, by the way, for all of you watching at home. It's time to get into the arena. How about some scriptures here? You are the light of the world. A town cannot be built on a hill cannot be hidden. We have the truth, everybody. It's time for us to proclaim it in the area and the city of which we are in. And my favorite new verse, right, Steve? My new favorite verse. And now we're going to get more and more specific. Have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. Ephesians 5:11. That's kind of my daily job, by the way. Have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. Okay, let's start exposing them. I'm telling you right now, Arizona's changing. It's not changing for the better. And we're all groaning because the Bible says we will groan. But when the wicked rule, the people groan. We have sat idly by for too long, everybody. And I also want to speak to the people that are here tonight that are not Christians. Welcome, by the way. And this has to be all of us working together. And I want to just say for a moment the vision that we have for Turning Point Faith. And Rob and I are going to be working on this, and pastors across the country. We are a secular 501c3 organization. We have people of all different sorts of faith backgrounds and beliefs. You guys know what I believe and why I believe it. But if we are serious about taking back this constitutional republic, which is a pluralistic society, we must employ the Galatians 3 model, which is that the law holds you in place until faith comes. And so we are not going to bring the church into Turning Point. We're going to try to bring the successful model of what we've done at Turning Point USA into churches and places of worship and religious institutions across the country. And here's why. When I see our Turning Point USA staff members who are incredible, or our Turning Point USA chapter leaders that are under attack every single day on these campuses, I say, man, if this 16-year-old can stand for truth at their high school campus, pastors can also stand for truth in their churches. How many of you are familiar in any way, shape, or form with the term critical race theory? Anyone? Good amount of hands, but still a fair amount of hands that did not raise. If I would have said that a year ago, probably 5 hands would have went up. So it's starting to get more out there. This is no joke. This is civilization-ending stuff, and you guys know I don't do hyperbole. This is the type of ideology that can destroy the ties that bind us together. It is anti-biblical. So what does the Bible have to say about race? Let's start about what we believe. God shows no partiality, but in every nation, anyone who fears him does what is right and acceptable to him. Acts 10:34. Galatians 3:28. There is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free. There is no male and female. You are all one in Christ Jesus. Galatians 3:28. Acts 17:26. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth. We look at the spirit and the soul, the character and the actions of people, not the skin color or the melanin content. But what if I told you that the opposite is being taught in schools across the country and, yes, in schools here in Arizona? So let me tell you what critical race theory is. Critical race theory is growing at a rapid pace across our country. It is harder to find schools that aren't doing it than schools that are. And they're camouflaging and disguising it, but they're starting to say the private part out loud. Here's what it is. It started in the 1960s. And if any of you are interested, you should read a book by James Lindsay called Cynical Theories. It's a terrific book on this topic. It's a belief that is an extension of the Marxist view of the world. We already heard Billy Graham's views on Marxism. That everything in life is a view of the oppressed and the oppressor. That everything in life is the bourgeoisie versus the proletariat. It's the people in charge and the people that aren't in charge. But critical race theory takes it even further. Critical race theory believes that white people, by definition, are the oppressors, and that black people or people of color are the oppressed. There is no escaping this paradigm. And the only way to make right for any wrong that they pinpoint is now to discriminate against the discriminators. Is now more discrimination against any sort of group is now the solution. So this is championed by someone by the name of Ibram X. Kendi. Anyone know that name? Well, you should get to know that name because they're having more influence on the education of your children than any other person. He's kind of the scholar, if you will, behind critical race theory. He has this philosophy called anti-racism. Has anyone heard that term recently? He believes that the world should be separated into racists and anti-racists. Here are some of his ideas. He believes that standardized tests are, quote, the most effective racist weapon ever devised to objectively degrade black minds and legally exclude their bodies. Capitalism, he says, that is a conjoined twin of racism. He believes that a race-neutral country or a racially blind country is, quote, the most threatening racist movement in the country. And his solution, in his own words, are, quote, the only remedy to racist discrimination is anti-racist discrimination. The only remedy to past discrimination is present discrimination. The only remedy to present discrimination is future discrimination. Now, if you think you're reading something from Nathan Bedford Forrest from the KKK of the Deep South, it's awfully similar. You see, I grew up in the suburbs of Chicago, 53% English as a second language high school, with people of different races and backgrounds. I was always taught to de-emphasize race, and it worked. We cared about character and values, not on skin color, not on these ridiculously arbitrary tribal lines that are being drawn. And where we are headed right now is a collision course that will tear our constitutional republic apart. So a lot of people say we got to get involved. We got to do something. Well, let's read Litchfield Elementary School District's press release. Anyone know where Litchfield Elementary School is? It's in Litchfield Park, Arizona, 272 East Sagebrush. They don't like it when you read this stuff, by the way. Now, let's make sure what we're doing is biblical, right? Have nothing to do with the fruitless deeds of darkness, but rather expose them. Got it. Okay, what we're doing is biblical. They wrote this Litchfield Elementary School number 17. This is elementary school. They have an equity statement. Some of it is rather nonspecific, so you got to dig, right? Because they don't think people actually read to the end of these things. And then you actually read, you're, oh, wow, thank you for admitting. We subscribe to the author Ibram X. Kendi's definition of racism. There is no in-between of safe space and not racist. So then I decided to have our team, hey, can you actually go find their work toolkit? Like, what are our kids, what are our seven-year-olds in Arizona actually learning? Now, I'm doing this intentionally because I think those of us that are in the public space, we get too broad too much. They're teaching this, they're all this, this is bad, and then we move on. It's time we start getting very specific. Let me show you what it says. They have discipline goals, which means to reduce disproportional discipline for black students, to reduce disproportionality in achievement for black and Hispanic students, and then to train all students and teachers in Ibram X. Kendi anti-racist teaching. I already told you what he believes, which is segregation is the solution. It goes through multiple pages. You guys can check it yourself, from the superintendent to the administration council. Now, thankfully, some parents are starting to rise up against this. In fact, on May 11th at 5 p.m. at the Litchfield Elementary School District, if anyone lives in the general area, I think it would be a good idea if you guys employ Ephesians 5:11 and say, segregation will have no place in Arizona as long as I have breath in my lungs. And it keeps on going, and we're going to post this all on our website. The Diverse Curriculum Committee, to have fine arts, audiovisual, language, and math and science and writing and technology around this curriculum. And it continues on. You guys can read the equity statement yourself, but now the people that will be held responsible for this are the teachers, the administrators, and the superintendent. This is the school board passing this. They're no longer doing this in the shadows. This is no longer a secret thing. It's all public. It's all out there. And so it's not just in Litchfield, by the way. The Arizona Department of Education has now issued a new equity toolkit for all educators to be able to lend from in the state of Arizona. Now, let's talk about this idea of equity. What a linguistic act of treachery that word is, isn't it? Because who could be against equity? Let's be very clear what equality is and then what equity is. Equality can be divided in two different categories. Equality of rights, equality of opportunity. But equity is something very different. So equality of rights, meaning that the law should be blind. That's why in the ideal we have the picture of Lady Liberty with a blind over her eyes. That no matter who you go in front of a judge, you will be treated under the same constitutional rights. That comes from the biblical idea, by the way, of non-preferential treatment in front of the law. Most countries are stunned and they're confused by how America was able to make this work. It's because the Bible inspired the writers and the framers of the U.S. Constitution. That's why a secular humanist type approach would not be able to get to this. Then there's equality of opportunity. This is why we should champion school choice. This is why we should talk about rebuilding the American family, which is the ultimate way to be able to curb poverty and instill morals in young children. Equality of opportunity. But then there's this really tricky word, equity. Boy, is equity a dangerous word. Equity means that we will redistribute the outcome based solely on things you can't change. I'm going to say that again. We are going to redistribute the outcome based on things you can't change, like skin color. Or let's just have Ibram X. Kendi describe it for us, who happens to be a scholar on this sort of stuff, where he says, discrimination now, no, that's right. The only remedy to present discrimination is future discrimination. The defining question is whether the discrimination is creating equity or inequity. He tells you right now, discrimination is the way to do this. If discrimination is creating equity, then it is good and therefore anti-racist. If the discrimination is creating inequity, then it is racist. And so he wants to create a new Department of Anti-Racism in the federal government that would be comprised of formally trained experts on racism and no political appointees. And it goes on from there. So at the Arizona Department of Education, they now have a new equity toolkit, where if you are even in nursery school, they are now teaching three-month-old babies and anyone involved that they are racist. The Arizona Department of Education has created an equity toolkit designed to teach critical race theory to children, offering a number of recommended readings on the topic. So let me tell you deeper into critical race theory what they believe. They do not believe in individuals. They do not believe that you are made in the image of God. They don't. They believe you're part of your tribal group. That's it. They believe you're part of who you look like. They don't believe that you are fearfully and wonderfully made, that you need to come in a connection with your creator. They believe you're nothing more than who you look like. They don't believe in math and science. They don't. They are outspoken critics of this idea of Newtonian physics. They think math and science are created simply and solely to advance and protect a white supremacist construct. They don't believe in dialogue. They don't believe in speech. Who is the greatest example of peaceful dialogue? Jesus Christ. Went around talking to people, asking questions, speaking truth as he was truth. They believe dialogue and speech is a false promise towards oppression. They also believe that racism is everywhere. It's in the sky, it's in the stars, it's in what you buy. And Ibram X. Kendi articulates this. And the only solution is massive redistributive equity. But this is now in the Arizona Department of Education. And it says one of the recommended readings is that as soon as children are able to speak, you must let children draw these conclusions based on what they see, which when it comes to race, which is a doctrinaire example of critical race theory in the Arizona Department of Education. It doesn't stop there. There's another equity event for the Arizona School Board Association. Anyone heard of this organization before? It's a little sneaky organization. The Arizona School Board Organization, ASBA. This event serves as a touchstone for diversity, equity, and inclusion enshrined in school policies statewide. So this is for all school board members to gather to learn how they can implement this in school districts across the state of Arizona. This, and I quote, the ASBA says that race should be focused on more intensely. Let me be as clear as I possibly can. If you think race should be focused on more intensely, you're a racist. They have all these speakers. This actually happened on April 21st. So now this is now going to spread into more school districts because they just brought in all the school board members and trained them up on what they need to be doing. And then they redeployed all the school board members across the country. Now, what's the one characteristic all school board members have in common? They're all replaceable. They have that all in common. It's kind of an amazing thing, is that you can replace them. And here's the other thing. All of you can be school board members too. That anyone in this room can then run for school board and start asking questions about these things. Do you know what's the one thing these people hate? They hate attention. It's amazing. They want attention all the time, except when it comes to these sorts of things. In fact, we were just talking early in Southlake, Texas. Let me tell you a story. This sort of nonsense was just spreading like you wouldn't believe. And we were just doing this on our podcast the other day. In Southlake, Texas, they saw this very curriculum being implemented to young children. So a bunch of parents got together and rose up, and they just had their election last Saturday. And by a margin of 70% going for the good guys and 30% for the bad guys, they rejected critical race theory in the local schools in Southlake, Texas. But it took us to get the message out, right? Because what was happening, and we just talked about this earlier, is, oh my goodness, I didn't know that. You see, they take advantage of your love of things that matter. Let me say that again. They take advantage of your love of things that matter. This shouldn't be the most important thing in your life. Your kids should matter more. Your church should matter more. Your business should matter more. They know you're distracted building. They know you're distracted creating, fruitfully multiplying. So they're sneaky. They know that you're not going to show up to the school board meeting. That's why they're sometimes even violating the Open Meetings Act, which is what happened in Southlake, Texas. That's why they don't like it when they get public comment. That's why they don't like it when they get emails from everyone. By the way, all of the emails for the Litchfield District are publicly available. You guys can look it up. You can do whatever you want. They don't like that. And if I were to offer one critique, if I may, of the conservative movement, we've thought way too national for way too long. We have just been so focused on Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer. Meanwhile, all this rubbish is just being passed every single day. And nothing's ever really going to change until Jeremiah 29:7 starts to happen, is to seek, which comes from that Hebrew word, badrash, demand, desire, the welfare, the shalom, the peace of the city which we are in. And so, a couple other examples, and I want to get to some questions, is that this school board, the equity event, happened on April 21st to 22nd. Most people didn't even know this happened. They had all these speakers, very, very radical speakers. And so now they're going to come back, and they're going to try to sneak this all throughout the state of Arizona. They're going to try to sneak it through maybe in Scottsdale, Paradise Valley, maybe in Glendale, maybe in Mesa, maybe in Chandler. And that's all of a sudden where this event is the equal and opposite reaction that they never would have ever thought was going to happen. That's why we're going to keep meeting every single month, and I'm going to be updating you guys. You know, this being taught here, you know, this person right here is doing their job and this person isn't. You see, this, I believe, is fulfilling a biblical commandment. And I'm going to tell you why. Rob and I have done study on this one word, and I've become obsessed over it. One of the most famous verses in the Bible is when Jesus comes up to the mouth of the Jordan River with his disciples at Caesarea Philippi, and he asks the question, who do you say that I am? Or who do men say that I am? And there's a dialogue that goes back and forth, and at the end of it, Christ says, on this rock, build my, we say church, but the word is ecclesia. In your free time, just go look up that one word. Just type that into a search engine, hopefully not Google, ecclesia. What are you going to find? Well, it tells you what an ecclesia is. An ecclesia was kind of a really special thing back in Jesus' time. It was not a religious gathering. It wasn't. An ecclesia was a local political gathering. Emphasis on local. In Greek times, when anything went wrong, when they wanted to figure out how they were going to levy taxes or figure out how they were going to educate their children, they said, we're having an ecclesia tonight. Tonight, we're going to have an ecclesia. So they'd have an ecclesia, and they would fast and pray before they entered, and then they would vote. And at every single ecclesia, they would have two other Greek words that were the words that they always tried to accomplish. call it kind of the North Star, Isonomia and Eleutheria, which means Greek words for freedom and equality. I wonder what country has those two words as central organizing principles. But then we go back to the scriptures where Jesus says, on this rock, build my ecclesia. Well, it wasn't synagogue, it wasn't temple. It was something more than that. And so what if I told you that for the last 20 years, if the church would have been doing what we're doing right now, just telling you what's happening, giving you some history, giving you some perspective, the organic, spontaneous action that's about to happen after tonight is exactly what the church should be facilitating, is that this is our biblical commandment, to make you aware that you have to take responsibility and leadership for what's happening around you. And so our vision, and this is what we've shared the entire time, is that we want other pastors to start to do this. And at Freedom Squares in Albuquerque and Dallas and Asheville and Raleigh and Miami and Des Moines and Omaha and Milwaukee, because I believe one of the reasons we're seeing what we're seeing is that good people are either unaware or they are uncertain on how to act with what's happening around them. They say, I know something doesn't feel right, and I got 35 pillows in my garage, but someone, he's the only guy that tells me what to do. It's true. Promo code Kirk, right, Barry? I'm kidding. You got to give it. He does do the direct ask. So I'm going to do the direct ask as bluntly as I can with the biblical commandment. It's time to no longer be spectator Christianity. It's time to be participant, everybody. And so I want everyone here to fast and pray over this the next couple days. And the next Freedom Square we're going to have is June 8th, which is, man, I'm not happy with what's happening at Litchfield. I'm sure a lot of you are. And they say all politics is local, and boy, isn't that the truth. And you think, what can I do about that? But better yet, I can contact, I can organize, I have friends there, I might show up at their next meeting, but I also might be really concerned that it's coming to a school board near me. Maybe you're going to run for mayor, which is one of the most important, least respected positions in the country, which is mayor races. Maybe it's city council. Maybe you're like, I can't run for anything, but I'm going to go support and pray for and help someone that is. I'm going to maybe, someone that's running for city council, maybe I'm going to just take care of their kids that night. Maybe my tithe and my offering for the community, I might not have the money to be able to give as much as I want to the church, but I'm just going to look after someone running for office who's a Christian, spirit-filled person. I'm going to look after their kids one night a week so they can go knock on doors and campaign. That's where the church all of a sudden starts to fill in the gaps of the reasons people say they don't want to run. Top reasons people say they don't want to run. I don't know how. Believe it or not, that's the number one reason. But look, you've seen who we have in elected office. It's not that hard, okay? Let me just say that is not a great. Number two, understandable. I'm afraid. They're going to attack me. They're going to smear me. They're going to malign me. You're right. It says in the scriptures very clearly, that is a guarantee of our faith. You should be praising the Lord when you get persecuted, because you're right where God wants you at that moment. And the third reason is I don't think anyone's going to support me. I don't know if anyone's going to get behind me. Well, look around you. Here we are in the valley with well over 1,200, 1,300 people that all are sharing that same common concern, that same belief. There's more of you than you could ever imagine. And one of the greatest tactics the enemy has ever pulled is making you feel as if you're alone. All the time. Man, I don't know if anyone else shares my values. I don't know if we have hope. I don't know if this can ever change. And I'm going to close with this, and then we're going to go to some questions, because we're going to have some dialogue. I'm going to tell you a tale of two different states. I want to tell you the tale of California and the tale of Florida. Two states that have similar populations and two completely different outcomes. California was going to be the state of the future. California was one of the most conservative states in the country. California was the place where you didn't matter where you were from, it didn't matter who your parents were, you could go there and you could succeed. California now is the laughing stock of the country. The governor's getting recalled, of which I wish him no luck. The The state is broken. They have lost population for the first time ever. I know many people part of the Calvary movement in California, of which Rob is part of, and many others, Jack Hibbs and James Cadiz and Joe Pettick and so many others. There was an agreement amongst the major churches in California. They said, we don't do politics. We don't do this. Well, ever since that moment, California has aborted more children than the entire combined population of Canada. Authors of no-fault divorce, transgender bathrooms, and people fleeing because they know that it does not represent their values. Now, can California be won over? I don't know. I'm hopeful. But the battle for California actually really isn't today. This is the battle to reclaim it. The battle happened when that inflection moment happened. It happened about 15, 20 years ago when it was legitimately a 50-50 state. So let's talk about Florida. Florida has more registered Democrats than Republicans. Let me say that again. Florida has more registered Democrats than Republicans. But something happened in Florida a couple years ago where all of a sudden, for whatever reason, call it Midwesterners like me that were fleeing Illinois, and someone that has a lot of courage and a lot of boldness, Florida is all of a sudden now the true state of the future. Florida has a 0% income tax rate. Florida said that you're not allowed to teach critical race theory in any schools across the state of Florida. Florida signed an anti-rioting bill, which says if you're traveling across state lines to Florida, you will face a minimum 10 years in prison. Florida has open carry. Florida has the most robust school choice programs in the country. Florida has a booming economy. They reopened their state against every other defiance, and they opened up a lot quicker than Arizona, let me tell you. In May of last year, with the second oldest population in the country, even older than Arizona, with the lower virus transmission rate and hospitalization rate and death rate than the 10 lockdown states on average combined. So you have two states. And Arizona is in the TBD category. It's a lot of people like me that are saying, you know what, I'm going to go all in for Arizona. I'm going to give it everything I got. And let me be very clear. I do not mean this politically. I don't. I mean this culturally, because all the politics stuff goes downstream from there. But in Florida, I could tell you, because people rose up courageously, people of faith, people of morals. Florida is a state where all of a sudden where you play a little bit of offense, it's like, whoa. All of a sudden, there's more of us than we could ever imagine. Where California was a state where it was like, you know what, we want to be cool and we want to be comfortable Christianity. And now you saw the result of that. Arizona is literally 50-50. 50% that want to see it go in the direction of California and 50% that want to see it go in the direction of Florida. You guys might not realize this or not. Everywhere I go, people ask me about Arizona. Everywhere I go, they ask about the audit. They ask about what happened. They ask about whether the state is going to be what they once remember it. You guys might have thought 5 years ago you lived in a kind of a boring political state with no big fights. You happen to be right where God wants you to be if you care about the future of this republic. You happen to be right in the middle of what matters most. And so we want to grow this. And I'm telling you right now, I'm going to give it everything I can. Because this can be done, everybody. Bold, dramatic type action. Where all of a sudden, we're sunsetting the income tax. Where we're saying no critical race theory in our schools. Where we are building up churches and people of faith. That's the sort of state that I know the values of Arizona deep down hold. The only thing that's missing is action. And so as we do this month after month, you guys can circle it on your calendar. Next one will be June 8th. Which is that Tuesday, and I want you to bring more friends. I want to fill this thing up eventually, and we're going to pack this up with new and exciting speakers. You know, we're going to have different teachings, and we're always going to have the teaching be adjusted to whatever's happening in the news cycle. What does the Bible say about immigration? What does the Bible say about race? And then we're going to get very specific. We're going to go through the marching orders of just not the big stuff, but then the stuff that you can actually do. And look, I'm telling you, everybody, if we act, we are going to make Arizona look like Florida and say, do not California, my Arizona. Let's do some questions, everybody, and God bless you guys. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, guys. All right, let's get to some questions. I want to get to as many as possible. You guys can form two lines in the two aisles. Just make them super quick. And we want to hear from students or from young families in particular as you guys wrestle with this stuff. Okay. Hey, man, good to see you again.
Hey, good to see you. Thank you for everything. I just wanted to ask, I'm sure you heard about Joe Rogan recently had to backtrack on some comments about young people getting the vaccine, specifically 21 and under. And with him backtracking, since he's on a bigger platform, do you believe that in the coming months and towards the end of the year, they will start limiting freedoms who have already made, for people who have already made up their mind that they are not going to get the vaccine?
Look, so I get asked about the vaccine all the time. So let me tell you, I'm by no means an expert in this, but I'm going to tell you personally what I've decided to do. I'm going to tell you why I decided what I did, and then you guys can make your own decision. I'm not in a place to judge you or to categorize you based on any of that. I am not getting the vaccine. Okay? And I will not use the force of government to mandate anyone else to get the vaccine. So, and I know some very close relatives and friends that have gotten the vaccine. Their reasoning is logical. I don't necessarily share that reasoning. But I will leave it to medical experts, of which Dr. Fauci is not, to answer those types of questions. And so, why? So people say, Charlie, why won't you get the vaccine? I'm 27 years old. I work out almost every single day. I eat well. I've been lied to for a year by the medical establishment. I'm going to take my chances. And again, that's my own position. I will tell you when I'm speaking from a position of authority. I am not speaking from a position of authority on this. Consult who you trust, read the literature that you find to be factual, and make an informed decision, of which that's why I love liberty. Make the decision you see fit. Okay, next question.
Hi, my name is Eric Hayes. Some of you that went to the Southwest Regional Conference
yeah.
know me as the Trump guy. Some of you, I don't know.
I remember that.
My question is, we had a conversation at the block party about how I kind of wanted to go down the path that you're going down.
I remember that conversation.
Yeah. And my question is, I've actually gotten a little bit of lashback from my family because like they're like really anti-social media. So I'm like thinking there's really like, that's like the only way to kind of like get your voice out there is social media and then obviously going to like school board meetings and stuff. What, is there anything else I could do? I mean, the power of social media is just so big now.
Yeah, so I think our conversation, just to fill everyone else in on what we talked about, is you have a talent, you're very funny, you do the best Trump impersonation I've heard west of the Mississippi. There's a guy in New York that does it better than you, but that's okay. So I said west of the Mississippi, it's pretty good, right? That's half the country. It's a very good impersonation. And you said, hey, Charlie, what should I do? And I believe that young people that have creative talent should try to create their own pages and channels and try to create their own spheres of influence, right? Especially people that are filled with the Spirit and that love the Lord. We need more people that are being good examples for others on social media, which is just so lacking. And so let me just clue you in. I don't like social media either. I really don't. And actually, my team manages social media for me. I'm purely a publisher, not a internalizer of anything on social media. I think it's mostly kind of mountains of garbage that is really not good for our soul. So let me first dive deeper, though. You need to first answer the question of why do you want to do what you do? And then the what will figure it out, figure itself out. And then the why needs to be, hey, I really want to see America go back to a place of strong ideas. I want to go back. I want to see America recommit itself to its true ideals of the founding. That, then all of a sudden you're going to fill it in from there. The how, there's 1,000 ideas I could give you right now that are even outside of social media. And you might say, well, what are some of those ideas? So whether it be running for office at a very local age, whether it be organizing your friends or starting a business, if you do it for the correct reasons, which is always to pursue righteousness and always to be obedient to the Lord, the rest will follow. And so I'm gonna challenge you. Think even more creatively outside of your horizons. There's a big world outside of social media. You have a talent. You really do. And social media is the easy way to do that right now. And maybe it is the right way, and maybe you'll be able to convince your parents, but there's always wisdom from parents that are trying to stop you from doing something. I love the Ten Commandments. The only one of the Ten Commandments with a promise is honor your mother and father so that you might live long and prosper of which in the land you are in. Somewhat paraphrasing, that's the essence of the commandment, which is every totalitarian government always breaks the bond between their children and their parents. And so take what they're saying very seriously. And if you feel differently, express that. But answer the why and use your skill and talent, and you're going to be just fine. Thank you. Appreciate it. Thanks. I like your shirt. That was a good year.
Thank you. Very good. Hey, Charlie. So my name's Jake. First of all, I just recently subscribed to your podcast. You can be Rachel Maddow in the numbers.
Thank you. If everyone subscribed to the podcast here, we would beat the New York Times in the podcast charts by tomorrow morning. So God bless you. That's very kind of you.
So my question is, about like 8 or 9 years ago, I went to this retreat at my church at the time, and the pastor was talking about how the average age of marriages are starting to go up, which wasn't really all that surprising. But then he talked about how the birth rate was going way down.
Yes.
And that was kind of surprising. And my thought was, is that, you know, nowadays, you know, a bunch of feminists and left-wing people are telling, you know, women like, hey, being part of a family, having a bunch of kids is all the patriarchy trying to keep you down. Don't worry about that. Just go work. Don't worry about having kids.
Yes.
So most of the people, I would imagine, for the most part, who are having 3, 4, 5 plus kids are more conservative or lean more towards that. So could you see maybe in like, I don't know, 20 years as the next generation becomes born, that a lot of more kids going on will be born more in that conservative family unit versus, you know, a lot of these feminists who may only have like one kid. So,
well, or they're like, I want one of each. Like they're picking out like tile or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
Look, be fruitful and multiply. That's not that hard to figure out. But look, you actually strike a really important point. I am such a vocal critic of this feminist movement that has infected the minds of young women across the country. It is so destructive. You just had a wonderful women's conference, by the way. I heard you had a very, very good event. Congratulations. It was terrific. I heard great things. And look, we are now seeing the byproduct of this insidious feminist movement in our country, which is a declining population rate, and I'm going to be very honest, the unhappiest generation of women America has ever seen. Very, very successful in career, but missing something that biologically and spiritually there's a pull on their spirit for, which is to get married and have children. And just from a purely civilizational standpoint, if you're not having children, the civilization will not continue. And so let me build that out even more. We're on the verge of a population collapse in our country right now. No one wants to talk about it, but the numbers are so unbelievable. We're on pace to have 600,000 less children this year versus last year. Now, let me tell you why that's really troubling. People would say, wait a second, you're going to lock everyone together in homes for a couple months. The birth rate is going to skyrocket. What if I told you that having children is a value? What if I told you that actually replicating yourself through children is not something that once you possess the technology that people automatically want to have done? That's a very interesting thing to think about. So we're on the verge of a population collapse, which politically, I don't know how that's going to work for them in 30 or 40 years, because basically we're going to have the ones that have very, very big families. I've offered this challenge. I've had one person ever offer me, and I don't even believe them, but that's okay. But it's an open standing offer, Dennis Prager and I as well, at freedom@charliekirk.com. Find me an atheist family with 5 or more kids. I have never found them. It's one, no, seriously, if you ever find that family, introduce me. There was one, it was kind of shaky. They were like deists. I said, aha, okay. So, no, but, right? And so, if you don't believe in the Lord, you usually stop at some point. And I'm not saying it's a bad thing, right? I'm just saying that religious people have always been the driving force of why to have children. Now, I'm going to go a step further. What's one of the top reasons that millennials are saying they don't want to have kids? The environment. It's true. They say that, why would I want to replicate myself to destroy the earth? Now, thankfully, we have the inerrant, perfect word of the Lord to tell us whether we should believe that or not. We should take dominion over the earth of which we are in. We should love the earth. We should respect it. But we have a human first philosophy when it comes to procreation, when it comes to government, and when it comes to families. No one should ever apologize for having a lot of children. They are a gift from the Lord. Now, we're now seeing this with this movement that thinks you can find satisfaction and fulfillment in materialism. So what we're really seeing right now is a collision course of two different worldviews, which is, do you believe the things that matter come in beauty, wonder, truth, and goodness, or things you can't always touch, but things you can explain and feel and know in your spirit? Or do you think things that matter come from materials? Do you think they come from things you can touch and things that give you pleasure? So the question is, what is liberty? So if you ask, and you're wearing that 1776 shirt, I'm going to mention on that in a second because it's a really special year for reasons that people might not always be able to articulate. In that year, that word liberty, if you guys ever see in Google where they say, like, how often was that word used and it, like, goes up in a certain year? The word liberty had, like, its best year ever in 1776. But the founding fathers did not define liberty the way that your children are being taught what liberty is. So here's how your children are being taught what liberty is. They're being taught liberty is being able to do whatever you want to do, however you want to do it, as long as it feels good because it's your truth. The founding fathers called that hedonism. They thought, they found that to be repulsive. Here's what liberty is. Being free and able to pursue virtue without government getting in the way. That's what liberty is. And so in the year 1776 was the year George Mason, one of my favorite founding fathers, wrote the Virginia Bill of Rights, which ended up being what we know as the first 10 amendments of the Constitution, which, by the way, they almost didn't make it. There's a whole drama of how the Constitution was almost never amended. It was the year Adam Smith wrote The Inquiry into the Wealth of Nations. It was the year that Thomas Paine wrote Common Sense. And, of course, Thomas Jefferson wrote the Declaration of Independence, where he famously said laws of nature and nature's God. So how do I tie all of that together? You asked about children and you asked about populating the earth and all of that. I'm getting married on Saturday. I highly recommend every young person does as well and have lots of children. That's my final recommendation. It's fine. Okay. Hey, guys, how you doing?
Good.
What's your name?
Evan.
What a great name. What's on your mind?
Why do older people want to sway younger children to one side, even though they're how many years away from voting?
What a great question. How old are you?
11.
11 years old. Give it up for Evan, 11 years old, having courage to do this. That's terrific. So, believe it or not, Evan, the things that you are taught and that you internalize at the age you're at right now actually might make more of a difference than the things that you are taught and that you internalize 10 years from now. It's what we call the formative years. And so you asked, why is it that adults want to influence children well before they can vote? Well, we know this in the Bible. We know that Jesus, first of all, was very, very clear about corrupting or going after young children for pernicious or evil ways. In fact, he said, it's better for you to have a millstone wrapped around your neck than to go after these little children. It's a very important piece of scripture to remember. But if I were to ask you what is good and what is evil, if I showed you two different events, and you'd be able to show me, because you are dressed literally in a tuxedo here tonight. So I'd imagine that you probably have very good parents. But if you get that wrong, or if you came up here and you believe, you know, there is no God, we're just a clump of cells, what do you look like when you're an 18-year-old? When you're an 18-year-old, all of a sudden the people that implanted that awful idea in your head, they're going to reap that harvest, whatever it might be. So the short answer, Evan, is that whomever controls the values, the morals, the decisions of you, the 11-year-olds right now, that's actually who's going to win the future. So when I went through this entire thing of Litchfield Elementary School, you don't go there, do you? Okay. They care about this because they care about what Evan's going to think like and vote like when you're 18. So they make the long-term investment, Evan. And what we have not done a good job of doing is care about the Evans, the 11-year-olds all across Maricopa County. What are they going to believe 7 years from now? And what's the role of the church and the role of the family in that regard? And so I just want to commend you for asking that question. Anything else on your mind?
No.
Well, thanks for being here, and God bless you, Evan. It's awesome. Thank you.
Hey, Charlie.
How you doing?
Good. You? Yeah. So I originally was going to ask a couple questions, but now I feel like I just need to say a few things kind of where the conversation has led. First of all, being fruitful and multiplying is the first commandment we are given in the entirety of the Bible. So that should be a good hint as to how important that is. Another thing I would say, I grew up in the church my entire life. And just some advice for parents and grandparents. It is extremely, it was just super common growing up to hear how challenging being a parent is. And basically, I would just give the advice to be careful about how you speak about parenthood. Because so many people that I know that grew up in the church, they just think that they can't do parenthood until they are graduated, until they have a good income, until, you know, all the pieces fall together. And in the 1940s, mm-hmm. that wasn't the case. So maybe it might be just good if you can maybe talk to just that issue in
sure.
our generation, because my wife and I are going to have our first kid in October.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Well done.
And we're
I think you are pointing at a great issue. And let me kind of tie that all together, is that we should be talking about the positives and the benefits of parenthood. And I have not experienced that. However, I hear 99% negative for one positive. The number one piece of feedback I get, even from Christians, is wait before you have kids. Your life is totally going to change, and eventually you're going to enjoy it. Just so you guys know, this is one of the reasons why young people don't have children, though. At least from a sales and marketing standpoint, like, just talk about it a little bit better, right? So I think you're getting at that exactly, right? Where it's like everyone is so freaked out and terrified, where in the 1940s or the 1920s is like, no, this is what we do, and it's wonderful, and you're going to have children. And it worked. And so I think that's a really important thing. And I kind of share that because it's kind of at this point where it's like, yep, everything's different. I sort of liked it. You know, it's like, seriously, there's people that are not always talking very glowingly about it. And there's obviously tons of wonderful examples there. But that has a big impact on young people that are thinking of making those decisions, more than you could ever imagine. And I want to second that. So thank you so much. I appreciate that. Next question.
Hey, Charlie, big fan. You know, a lot of people work out to secular music. I work out listening to your podcast. So
thank you.
Yep, no problem. It was cool listening to you hear or talk about education. I'm finishing up my first year of teaching, something I'm really passionate about.
Congratulations. We need more teachers. That's awesome.
Thank you. My question would be like a two-part question. First is, how do we get more people like me who are passionate about today's youth, and who are strong Christian moral people into this occupation? And second, how do we keep them there? Because it is very, very hard to stay in this education. It's been a very tough year just as a strong Christian young person.
Are you a current teacher?
Or? Yeah. I teach 7th and 8th grade PE. So
wow.
It makes it even harder. Yeah.
That's awesome.
So it's been tough, and I'm going to stick through it, but it's been very tough. Once parents found out, I did a little bit of social media on conservative before I got into teaching. So once they found that, it made it very tough. They were always trying to push me out of the job, making up stuff. So it's like, how do we get more people like me into the career, and how can we keep them in that job throughout the entire career?
Well, first of all, I want to encourage you, because you're right where you need to be, which is it's so important. And you're living out the gospel, just so you know, because you're going into a place that you aren't always welcome, where it's going to be difficult, and you're going to be able to minister to kids that, you know, and some of you might say, oh, PE, what's the difference? No. You know what they teach in PE? They teach, I don't know if in Arizona, but sexual education. They teach a lot of that stuff, at least in Illinois. So you want to talk about someone that has a good moral compass in that, you know, that environment. It's very, you're going to touch people's lives in a very, very special way. So get tenure is my first piece of advice, as quickly as possible, and then you can have a lot of fun. No, seriously, because we need to start using tenure against these people. We always complain about tenure, right? Can't fire teachers, can't this. Okay, then wait your turn, get tenure, ride it out. Hope that they don't know this video or whatever, but, you know, a couple people watch this, but you'll be fine. And by the way, we'll come to your defense if they try to do anything to you. If they try to even say one word to you, we're going to come to your defense. I'm going to tell you what, because we're not going to tolerate that. And we, and just for young people out there, you know, whether it be a teacher or whether whatever it is, that is such an important calling, because you're going to be in really molding the minds for the next generation. And so, and then finally, stay really close to the word every single day. Very important. It's easy when you work in the secular world to kind of just drift away from it, but to find that 10 minutes, those 15 minutes every single day, it's critically important. And so God bless you, man. That's really important. Thanks for being here. Thank you. We'll get to as many as we can. Yes.
Hey, Charlie, I'll make it quick. I'm from up north in Yavapai County.
Wow. And, thank you for coming. Jeez.
You're welcome. It's been a long day. I started work at 5 a.m. today and came here as soon as I got off.
That's awesome.
But in that, in addition to my job, I'm trying to rally my church members, my friends, everyone around. And I just, sometimes it feels like a string from a fire hose of trying to stay on top of all the issues, contact senators, contact the governor and all that good stuff. Is there any tips that you might have for helping that flow to be more of a trickle and less of a fire hose?
Yeah, I just want to first thank you for making the long journey down here. That's awesome. And so, yeah, we try to do that on our podcast to give kind of a condensed version of kind of what's happening and where it is. I would recommend try to find 5 or 6 people in your church that share your values and share your concern, and start a group and name that group. Come up with some title, like we're the freedom fighters of whatever church that is. Now, why does the name matter? Once you name something, it becomes real. That's why once we named Freedom Square, it became a real thing. You name children for a reason. So you come up with a name, and your 5 closest friends, whatever it might be, right? And you have a network then where you guys are going to be working together on the issues around. And you might be texting and supporting each other, but you shouldn't have to just do that alone. And there's so many people that share the concern you have. And if anyone is from your part of the world here tonight, maybe there's a network or a connection that can happen, or someone's going to listen to this podcast and email us. And I'd love to help you, because I could tell you that the pressure that you feel, which is a lot, you're up at 5 a.m., you're working, you're driving down here, you're driving back. I'm telling you, there's other people that are just waiting to be asked to pitch into that. But you form a small local community. Now, let me give you an example of how small local organic communities founded our country. This country was founded in the midst of the night without British being able to detect it, with 10 or 12 people meeting at taverns and pubs and bars all across the Eastern Seaboard. And yes, in churches as well. It was the local community. It was 10 or 12 people that saying, hey, did you guys hear about this Jonathan Edwards guy, this George Whitefield guy? Hey, this Thomas Jefferson guy's writing this document, and it's pretty aggressive. And like, it was all of a sudden these like local spontaneous conversations. And so I would go out of your way to form community. And I'm going to say that to everyone else in the room. If you're not part of a community, forget the Republican thing, okay? That has their own. I'm talking about community of values and community of action locally, right? 5, 6, 7 people. We're going to get coffee once a month. We're going to talk about the news. We're going to get dinner, whatever it is. All of a sudden, that's where spontaneous action comes out of it. And the American founding, in a lot of different ways, was an extension of that. And then just pray for wisdom. It's the one thing that God says he gives generously. James 1:5. You pray for wisdom, God will give you wisdom for what you need. And I just want to encourage you. I could tell in your eyes and just in the posture of how you ask the question, you really want to do good for your community. And I'm blessed and touched by that, truly. So God bless you. Thank you. I know that t-shirt. I've worn that t-shirt before.
Yeah. Hi, Charlie. My name is Sophia Van Arsdale. I'm a senior at high school in California, Coronado High School.
Wow.
And I'm going to go to Liberty University this fall.
It's a great school. Terrific.
Law and policy. So I'm super excited.
Good.
My question is about a certain thing that's happening at my school right now. There's a program called No Place for Hate, and it's basically connected through the Anti-Defamation League, which is basically a very woke like organization, and they're implementing it in our schools, and they're basically painting it as a thing to combat bias and prejudice in the schools. But of course, I did my research on it, and it's a total thing against all conservative values. Like, if you say all lives matter, you're immediately labeled as a hateful person and creating an unsafe space in the community. So my question is, how can I expose the truth about this organization on my campus to make people wake up and realize that it's not combating prejudice or bias, like whatever they label that as or define it as, but it's an attack on our values as Christians and conservatives.
Yeah, amen. Well, first of all, you're a senior in high school. God bless you. I mean, and just so you guys know, this is part of the plan, which is I try to get people that are over the age of 40 to hear, and you see how hard young people are fighting for this stuff, to try to raise the level of engagement. Because if you have a senior at Coronado, which is used to be conservative, Rob went was grew up around there.
Yeah. Coronado, San Diego.
Oh, okay.
Oh, no, it's San Diego.
You're in San Diego.
California.
Yeah, she's from California. Yeah. Yeah. So then all of us can raise our game a little bit. So let me just tell you right now, that's a really tough fight. I'm not going to give you false hope. I'll tell you when a fight is winnable and when a fight isn't. You're a senior, so you got like a couple weeks left, maybe. That's a tough fight. So I'm just going to be perfectly honest with you, because the way they frame it is around making people feel good, but then it actually becomes very totalitarian in nature, which is if you dare say these certain things, we're going to crush you. Remember, this is one of the things that we all have to remember. These movements always have a totalitarian bend to them. They almost always end in a smaller group of people controlling more for a purpose of which they desire, right? So I would instead just try to spark some conversations with a couple friends and just ask a very specific question. Why is it wrong to say all lives matter? Just find something very specific. With a couple weeks left in high school in Coronado, in a school that you're going in, that's going to be tough. But I hope you guys all understand, this is a well-funded program that's in schools all across the country that is being implemented, and it's very, very serious. But I do want to say, I hope you get involved with Turning Point USA at Liberty, and stay conservative and stay involved, and you're going to have a really good time there. So God bless you. It's terrific. Thank you. All right, we'll get to a couple more, as many as we can. Yes.
Hi, yes. I wanted to ask about the best way to go about creating a dialogue, a more meaningful dialogue with like the liberals in like our own lives or just in general. I know like the last two talking points were like more church setting oriented.
Yes.
And going to more to the school setting oriented. But like what about more at home or with family or at like the workplace setting, at which I know can be a very big gray area sometimes.
So awesome question. So dialogue is one of my favorite English words because it comes from two Greek words, dia, through, and log, logos, reason, which is actually right in John 1, one of the two creation stories. So Genesis and John, the same creation story told differently. And so I'll tell you this, that we don't have enough dialogue happening in our country right now. And that, they actually don't want it. They do not want discourse. They do not want conversation. They do not want speech. And so if there's one other marching order for everyone here is go embrace as many conversations as possible. And the tough ones matter the most. So if I can tell you guys a little bit of, not tough love, but things that we all know to be true. And I'm part of this. The conversations that are most essential to our nation are the ones that we don't want to have. The ones with family members, friends, and neighbors. We're happy to go knock on a stranger's door and say, hey, here's what you should believe and why you believe it. But your sister, your brother, your uncle, your aunt, like, nope, that's too close to home. So how do you do that? Do what the Lord did. Ask questions. Just ask, why do you believe what you believe? Has it ever worked? Where do rights come from? How's it working in New York City? How's it working in Seattle? Why are so many people leaving California if it's so wonderful? Why do they lead the nation in homelessness? If you're asking questions, you're immediately putting them on a pedestal to have to explain their worldview, and then you can navigate the conversation correctly from there. But I just want to say, as soon as we stop talking to each other in this country, we're going to start tearing each other apart. Speech is a biblical value. Let me say that again. Speech is a biblical value. The Lord spoke into existence. The Lord spoke into existence. We must never forget that speaking amongst and with each other is something that ties us together, keeps us decent with one another. And so I want to just commend you for your question. I think it's incredibly important. So thank you. All right, we'll get to a couple more.
Hi, Charlie. My name is Kimberly. I just graduated from Northern Arizona University, or as I like to say, I survived it.
Oh, good.
My question is not on my behalf, but it's on my mother's. She is a teacher at a public school that shall remain unnamed.
For now.
For now. And she, their district has not yet implemented the critical race theory or the equitable training that you mentioned that Litchfield is doing. However, she has mentioned to me privately that she has had staff meetings and department meetings and even emails from her administrators encouraging her to independently teach her students critical race theory and equitably grade her students, which means she can't fail them. And she's not willing to fight this. She's trying to fight it. She doesn't know how much longer she can last. Yeah. But my question is, how can she continue to fight this? And how, more importantly, how can parents who don't know about this, where this isn't happening at school board meetings, it's happening in staff meetings, how can they fight this?
So this is part of why we're doing this. And I want to reinforce this. I'm really good at exposing things. We are at Turning Point USA. We got it, and I know that you pray on it, and you can always email us directly, freedom@charliekirk.com. I'm not going to put you on the spot. But if, you know, we have a whole team that screens all these tips. But part of our show always is exposing what's happening. And then I guarantee you, wherever she's a teacher, there are parents that would be outraged to hear that. So here's what has to start to happen. The teachers are kind of, they're being told what to do, and they're in that position, is that parents here in this room, I don't know when the municipal elections are. I think they're different in each area, but they're coming up, which is got to start taking back these school board positions and find out at the very least who they are. Can anyone name every single one of their school board members? Anyone by name? And you pray for them and the issues they're dealing with? Well, it tells us in 1 Timothy to pray for the leaders by name so that you might live quiet and peaceable lives. So at the very least, by the next Freedom Square, just have your guys listed out that you're praying for every single day. And then prayer will lead to action and communication. Here's an action item for everyone. Schedule a coffee with your school board member, one of them, before the next Freedom Square. How about this? After our honeymoon, I am going to pop up spontaneously at one school board meeting a month in Arizona or nationally and just give public testimony. And so until we start to lovingly put pressure on these school boards, nothing's going to change. I can do a segment on our podcast, but until you, the people that you guys go to football games with and you go soccer games with, when you show up at that meeting, you say, no, Ibram X. Kendi is not going to be in Scottsdale schools. It's not going to be in Paradise Valley schools. And here's the final thing is they are really afraid of you guys rising up and doing this. And guess what? It takes like 20 people. It does. I'm not talking about a legion of 2,000 people. 20 people can totally change the direction of one of these meetings. And yes, there's a reason why they put them in the middle of the night on Tuesday evenings. There's a reason why they do that, okay? But look at South Lake, Texas. All it takes is to get that information out there. And education. I think we all agree that if we don't get education right, everything else is going to fall apart. That we got to get education right. And from there, other things are going to start to correct. Thank you so much. We'll take one or two more. I don't want to keep you guys too late.
Hey, Charlie. My name is Chris. I'm from a small town in Pocatello, Idaho, in a church of about 50 people. And so my question is, as Turning Point grows and as more churches get involved with this, we're going to have thousands and thousands of people. And obviously, the left is going to figure out that we exist. So at that point in time, we're going to have people like Don Lemon who like to twist our messages and say that the church is becoming political. And at that point, the government may end up attacking all of these small churches at once. So how do churches start to begin to prepare and get ready to attack or defend themselves from the federal government? Because that's what the separation of church and state was for in the first place.
Wow. So do you know why I love that question? He's actually thinking about the chess game. And this is something that's my biggest complaint of the Republican Party. They're always playing just what's happening, not what they're trying to force to happen next. So let me give you a couple examples of your brilliant question, why it's important. They don't want to abolish the police in America. They do not want to abolish the police. They want to create a national police force. So they want to vacate the police and then have crime go up. And then the solution will be a federally trained critical race theory police force. You could see that happening like that, couldn't you? Of course. It's not that they don't want any police. They want police that work for them. So that's two moves ahead, right? Same thing with inflation. They want to create money out of thin air. Why? Do they want prices to go up? only as a means to what end? Well, the left wants to politically remake the country at any cost. Well, you can solve inflation through three different ways. You can solve inflation through either raising taxes, raising interest rates, or massively expanding your immigration policies. Because if more people are trading with dollar bills, it therefore is a hedge against inflation. Well, that would give them an excuse to do mass amnesty in the country. Inflation will necessitate an argument for mass immigration. Start to see how some of these things are connected more. Same thing with your point. If the churches start to rise up, then all of a sudden the federal government is probably going to come at once against the small ones, the ones that can't defend themselves, and put metaphorically try to make show trials out of them, Soviet-style show trial. So let me say a couple things. I personally am going to lend my platform and everything we do to try to defend any pastor, any church that comes under attack or persecution from the federal government. That's number one. Number two, we must be very clear and we must say the thing we fear out loud, because then they're going to be less likely to do it. They always try to sneak attack us or surprise us. We must say, look, we know that the federal government is going to try to persecute Christianity. We know that's coming next. The third thing is this, is that nothing we said here tonight by any means whatsoever is against any federal regulation at all. We talked about values, we talked about education, and I was also very clear about not staying away from politics. The church is safe harbor territory there. And finally, I'll say this, is the pastors do have to start to say, you know what, this is a time for boldness. There might be a cost, there might be a price, and we do have to be bold. But I want to say this, the smaller churches have an understandable fear. But they can know that if they stand in boldness, they're going to have a big support network behind them. They're going to have, and this, just so you guys know, we have, at Turning Point Faith, we already have over 100 pastors that are coming out together. And this is going to be in conjunction with Freedom Square and all this. They say, you know what, we want to stand not just for this, but with each other. I'm going to tell you about one pastor that needs your help and your prayers right now. Someone that you should pray for by name is Pastor Mike McClure, Calvary Chapel, San Jose. He opened up his church fully in May of last year, and he's facing $2.7 million in fines from the local community. What you are doing right now, sitting in a chair listening to me, is costing him hundreds of thousands of dollars a week. But he says, you know what? You can fine me all you want. You can take my property. You can do whatever you want. The people we have won over to Jesus is worth whatever fine that you're going to throw to me on earth. And I'm inspired by Pastor Mike McClure. I'm inspired by what he's been able to do. And so I get it, but just also understand, you know why they've been afraid? Is because I believe there hasn't been a support network before that has been willing to put the arm around the shoulder of the 50-person church and say, you know what? You're going to come after that pastor. You're going to have to go through Turning Point, the Charlie Kirk Show, and Freedom Square, and Dream City, and all of us. We're not going to put up with that. Thank you so much. We'll take one more if we can, one or two more. Thank you.
Hello, my name is James. I'm from Tempe, literally right across the street from ASU. And my question is more of what your thoughts on. If the left supports abortion, why not just let them kill themselves off and make our job much easier?
Well, look, I could tell you're kidding. here's why. Every life matters. It doesn't matter if they're Democrat or Republican or liberal or conservative. Truly. Every single life matters. And look, I'm not going to get into the utilitarian ethics, but I reject utilitarian ethics, right? I believe that we must espouse ultimate truth and we must defend moral righteousness regardless of any of that. And by the way, everyone gets abortions regardless of political beliefs. And I just want to say that, you know, from the sarcastic question that you asked. But look, I think that we have to be very clear of when life begins. And then a million abortions a year in our country is a bad thing for everyone. It's a bad thing. And by the way, if we can't get that right, what else are we getting wrong in our country? And so I appreciate the sarcastic question. I understand where you're coming at from it. So thank you so much. Thanks. All right. I think this will be our last question. Sorry, guys. We got to draw the line at some point. Sorry. Yes.
Hi, Charlie. I'm Jaden Grandin. I'm a freshman at Cactus Shadows High School in Cave Creek. And I'm part of the Turning Point chapter, and I'm soon to be a leader there. And this year, just they've put a lot of roadblocks up for us to expand Turning Point, and they've really tried to, like, shut it down. So I'd like to ask, what would be your advice to fighting these school administrations and keeping Turning Point going?
So what school is it?
Cactus Shadows High School.
Cactus Shadows High School. What district is that in?
Cave Creek, 90.
Cave Creek. Does anyone live there here? Then do something about it. Yeah, that's not you, them. So let's just be very clear so that there's marching orders. Cave Creek School, they're giving you a hard time to start a Turning Point group.
We already have one started.
I'm sorry, just...
Oh, we already have one started. They just tried to, like, kind of shut it down.
Okay. And so your question is how to continue to navigate that?
Yeah, and, like, fight the school administration.
What is the school administration trying to do?
They're just trying to... They just don't want us to... Like, they've kind of stopped. They won't let us have meetings. Like, we weren't able to have meetings. We weren't able to, you know, put posters up or set up, like, stands and stuff like that.
Okay, so just some people that live in Cave Creek should... yeah, so you said Alliance Defending Freedom. I love them. But this is different than just a lawsuit. This is going to just take a couple... Trust me, these administrators are very, very weak. I see... No, seriously. A couple emails and a phone call. We don't need to file a lawsuit. Like, this is not lawsuit territory. This is what... So there's two different things that happen here, right? Where there's lawsuit territory and then just parents standing up. The administrative roadblocks is 90% of what we deal with at Turning Point. 10% is legal. And I'll tell you, the 90% is fixed if you just stand up, be like, hey, stop bullying these kids, okay? No one elected you. Just let them do what they want to do. Thank you so much. It takes like five parents to say that. Now, if they were to go make a big, like, public deal about it and try to block it, then we get into the legal domain. But insofar that it's just kind of like, hey, they're making it hard, it's annoying, a couple parents rising up, sending some emails saying, they better not have any problems again or else we're going to show up in massive numbers at the Cave Creek School Board. It fixes it like that. So, and thank you for saying that, by the way. It's terrific.
Thanks so much for listening, everybody. Email us your thoughts, freedom@charliekirk.com. And if you want to support us, go to charliekirk.com/support. God bless you guys. Speak to you soon.